Mr. Cousins?
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court. If I may, Your Honors, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case asks whether a felony sentence can be reviewed for legal error even when that sentence falls within the permitted statutory range. And when the defense asked this court the same question 3 years ago in State versus Johnson, the answer was unanimous yes. But here, when the state appealed from concurrent sentences, the 10th District refused to review the doubly incorrect allied offense ruling beneath those sentences, and it refused merely because concurrent terms serendipitously fell within the authorized range for the offense. Now, this is not the meaningful appellate review guaranteed by the General Assembly, and the state asks that the 10th District's judgment be reversed for two main reasons. First, a sentence can be contrary to law within the permitted range when an express error prevents the trial court from considering a valid sentencing option.
So, Counselor, is that really the heart of your argument here, that we should be defining contrary to law in the fashion that you're going to just describe to us?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The second point is the impact of the 10th District's decision, but to address your point, the 10th District's holding has rendered Revised Code Sections 29-29-11 and 29-29-12 meaningless, because it is held that a sentence cannot be contrary to law within the permitted range, even when there's an express error. And in Johnson, the trial court believed that consecutive sentences were required by Revised Code Section 29-29.13F. This court held that that belief was wrong and that the statute imposed no such requirement. And even though consecutive terms were authorized by law, even though they could have been imposed anyway, this court reversed because it recognized that the trial court's mistaken belief prevented it from exercising its discretion to determine whether consecutive sentences were appropriate.
So that's really, even if we weren't to find contrary to law, your argument then is we could at least find abuse of discretion because the court didn't exercise its discretion based on an erroneous belief.
Correct, Your Honor.
Two ways we could get at this, in your opinion?
Correct. The state contends that the contrary to law standard is still the standard and that the General Assembly has prohibited an abuse of discretion standard, but if this court were to apply an abuse of discretion analysis, the failure to exercise discretion is necessarily an abuse of that discretion.
Although before Senate Bill 2, the state did not have the ability to appeal sentences until 29-5308 was established and allowed for the sentences that are contrary to law to be appealed, correct?
The state could not appeal under that specific ground. There's case law from this court, and I haven't cited it in my brief, but where the trial court considers factors that it shouldn't have, and the court before Senate Bill 2 has found sentencing error in that circumstance. But here, this court's consistently held that although Foster has given trial courts full discretion to impose a sentence within the range or to impose multiple sentences consecutively or concurrently, that discretion must be exercised pursuant to Ohio's felony sentencing statutes. Courts have to consider 29-29-11, 29-29-12, and as this court stated in Mathis, any statute specific to the case itself. This court said that consistently in Mathis, in Saxon, and even in Bates, but this is the case where this court can define what those statutes actually mean. 29-29-11 and 29-29-12 do have force, and they are cast in mandatory terms. The General Assembly has required guided judicial discretion during the imposition of every felony sentence.
And you would have the Court of Appeals handling more cases on this basis. Rather than limiting contrary to law, you would have us expand the terms so that there would be more appeals on behalf of the state.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that the state was allowed to appeal before this court even decided to accept the case, but the 10th District has stated now in very clear terms that the state is not. So I think that the law ever since Senate Bill 2 has been the state can appeal when the trial court commits an express legal error, whether or not the error results in a sentence within the range. But I believe an abuse of discretion standard would create many more appeals, because even when there's no express legal error in the record, an appellant could argue that the term was unreasonable, and you get into this reasonableness comparison between appellate courts and trial courts, and I believe that's why the General Assembly has stated that an abusive discretion standard does not apply.
Well, given what's been long held that a court speaks through its journal entries, at the sentencing hearing, there was objection, I believe, to the sentence. The trial court relied on an inapplicable case. Did someone bring up State versus Johnson at the sentencing hearing, ask the court for reconsideration? Because it appears the 10th District didn't address the merger issue because it wasn't properly in the journal entry. The court, no matter what the judge said during the sentencing, in the journal entry, entered concurrent sentences, which was permissible under the statute.
Well, the state argued under Rance, Johnson wasn't yet decided by that point, but at the hearing, the state argued that felonious assault and third-degree felony domestic violence are not allied offenses under 2941.25 as interpreted by Rance. The defense argued against merger, and then the trial court held that it had no alternative but to merge the crimes.
But here the court didn't merge it by its journal entry. The court just entered concurrent sentences. Isn't that the crux of the argument?
Correct, Your Honor. That's what the 10th District held. They looked only to the fact that concurrent sentences were imposed. And that misses the point of the state's appeal. The error here is not the sentence that was imposed. It's the sentence that was never considered. And in this case, the record expressly shows that the trial court did not consider consecutive sentences.
Counsel, does the journal entry mention anything about merger?
The journal entry states that concurrent sentences were required pursuant to State versus Harris, which of course, is this court's allied offense decision, which actually prohibits concurrent sentences when merger is actually required. So a court does speak through its journal entries, but a court can commit sentencing error elsewhere. And even on the face of the journal entry in this case, the court is saying, pursuant to State versus Harris, I'm imposing concurrent sentences pursuant to an allied offense decision. Essentially, the court believed that the allied offense statute required mandatory concurrent sentences. And the state concedes that if these two crimes are in fact allied offenses, the state's not prejudiced by imposing concurrent sentences for allied offenses, but the state is prejudiced by the trial court refusing to consider consecutive sentences based on this allied offense belief. And this allied offense belief is what the state was seeking appellate review of.
Did the court reference Rance in its decision or just Harris?
The trial court just referenced Harris, Your Honor. That was the case relied upon by the defense counsel. The prosecutor was relying on Rance primarily.
Counsel.
And we've changed the law in Rance, in Johnson.
Correct. This court unanimously overruled Rance in the syllabus of Johnson.
Counsel, if we were to accept your argument, what action are you asking us to take?
I'm asking this court to reverse the 10th District's judgment, adopt the state's propositions of law first, and then remand the case to the 10th District for an allied offense determination. Because the issue here, Your Honors, is not whether felonious assault and felony domestic violence are in fact allied offenses. This court did not accept the state's third proposition of law dealing with that issue. So I think that the narrow issue here today is whether the state was even allowed to raise that issue in the Court of Appeals. So I think the appropriate disposition would be remanding this case to the 10th District with instructions to determine whether the court correctly refused to consider consecutive sentences. Now, I have briefed to explain why there is appealable legal error, why the trial court's merger belief was as wrong today under Johnson as it was under Rance and as it was in the decades before Rance. But I think given this court's acceptance of the first and second propositions of law only, that the appropriate disposition would be to send this case back to the 10th District. And the 10th District's holding sets a very clear and very flawed precedent that will only allow state sentencing appeals, and even defense sentencing appeals, when the sentence exceeds the statutory limit. If the trial court believed in this case that prison was required or prison was prohibited, that belief could not be reviewed on appeal because community control is an authorized sentencing option and a possible prison term could be an authorized sentencing option.
We have something in this case that we might not find in many cases of this nature, and that is the judge on the record stating that it would do something different, but for its mistake of law. Is that your essentially your argument? We have something more in this case than just the bare journal entry to go by?
Correct, Your Honor. I think that this court didn't have in Johnson in 2008 an express statement of what the court would have done, and this court still found reversible error because it was clear that the court refused to consider something or did not consider something fully. But under the appellate statute under 2953.08G, when a sentence is claimed to be contrary to law, the review is not limited to the sentencing entry. It says the appellate court shall review the record. And the appellate rule 9 defines the record as including the transcripts of the proceedings as well. And the standard is clear and convincing. So even if there's a rote recitation of the sentencing statutes considered in the entry, when the transcript of the hearing affirmatively proves that the trial court believed it could not exercise its discretion, then the sentence is clearly and convincingly contrary to law. Your Honors, if there are no further questions on that point, I would like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Acorn.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, counsel for the state, Mr. Cousins. When the trial court issued this decision, and one of the fundamental disagreements we have is that he is saying the trial court committed clear legal error by basically abandoning the discretion that it has in imposing consecutive sentences. What this is a veiled or camouflaged attempt to argue the allied offense issue. He keeps saying the trial court got it wrong, and there is, Justice Kupp, you mentioned the language the trial court used in that I have to run these things concurrent. He meant I have to merge them, that domestic violence and felonious assault, in his opinion, merge. And under Johnson, and that issue was briefed by both parties, even though that specific proposition wasn't accepted, it really is before the court. Because instead of saying that 29, 11, and 12 were violated and the judge abandoned his discretion, what he is saying is the judge got it wrong when he determined that those two offenses merge.
Counsel, shouldn't that be a valid reason then for remanding it to the trial court and allow the trial court to apply Johnson to this case?
I guess, in my opinion, Your Honor, the trial court already got it right. He already determined on the record, we'll look at the transcript, I'll take his language. He said, I have to merge these offenses. And under Johnson, under the language in the Johnson opinion from Chief Justice O'Connor's concurrence and Chief Justice Brown's concurrence, if the conduct could possibly result in either one of these offenses, they're allied offenses. And that's all that was argued at the sentencing hearing. There was no animus or separate conduct analysis done by the trial court. So if this court, I think this court can take Johnson and look and see, did the trial court get it right when they said these have to merge? Then the only error left is that he ran them concurrent instead of merging them. And in my opinion, that only inures to my client's benefit or detriment, and we chose not to appeal this case. The only error the state has, in my opinion, after Johnson, is that the judge technically did not merge the offenses. He ran them concurrent. And that, how does that, I guess I would ask, affect a substantial right of the state? And I'd ask the court to look at the record. There was no objection in this case. As you mentioned, Justice McGee Brown, the court actually didn't merge the offenses. Well, there was no objection. In fact, the prosecutor thanked the trial court after they entered the ruling. Then when we go to the 10th District, there is not, I would ask the court to look at propositions of 1 and 2. Those are nowhere in the single assignment of error that the prosecutor brought to the 10th District. The prosecution, the state of Ohio, is responsible for the opinion that the 10th District issued because they were only asked to look at whether or not the judge erred in trying to merge these offenses. There was no assignment of error that said, did the court improperly abandon its discretion and not running these consecutively, for example? I submit to the court, when you look at Johnson, and in my opinion, you see that felonious assault and domestic violence do merge under just the syllabus of Johnson, that the court did not commit an express legal error when it decided that they should merge. The only error was this mechanism, the mechanical functioning of how you actually merge. You don't run them concurrent. You actually obviously give the prosecution of choice between one or the other.
If Johnson signals a change in the law, why shouldn't either the trial court or the appellate court have the opportunity to consider it in this case? Because it didn't have the opportunity to do it at the time the trial court imposed sentence in the first instance.
Your Honor, as to the trial court, as I said, I think the trial court got it right. The right determination, and I think this court can look at it when they look at the offenses and the conduct that is in, that is present in the sentencing hearing, Your Honor, they already came to the right conclusion, the only conclusion you could come after Johnson. My client assaults his live-in, the mother of his children, and there's serious physical harm. It's conduct. It's absolutely possible to commit both of those offenses. So I guess what I'm saying is the conclusion, in my opinion, is indisputable. So there's no need to remand it.
Look at the conduct of the defendant. I mean, I don't know what the testimony is, obviously. I believe her eyes were swollen shut, and she had a fractured or deviated septum. Am I right?
My recollection is that there was a concussion and that there were abrasions. I mean, it was obviously injuries to the head, yes.
So could the separate blows be separate counts?
Well, that wasn't argued at the sentencing hearing.
Obviously, we don't know what the
right. I guess
that.
I'd ask you just to look at the sentencing transcript. That I know that there was no trial. This obviously was a plea, but this happened. This was a fight between a man and a woman that lived together, that had children together, and resulted in the injuries that this woman suffered. This isn't something that happened over a set of days or hours, as far as I'm concerned. It was a fairly contained incident. And again, the conduct, or I should say the animus issue and the act issue, really wasn't it wasn't argued. It was purely
counsel,
whether they were
out. Yes. The court didn't decide whether these offenses should have merged or they shouldn't have merged. The appellate court took a look at it, did the math, and decided that the number of years that this defendant, your client, was sentenced was as far as they needed to go. And those number of years were contained, arguably, in the sentence, and that was sufficient in their mind to overrule the state's assignment of error. And they said, even if we were to conclude that the court's decision to impose concurrent sentences had been based on faulty reasoning, the fact remains that the court's order that the sentences be conserved concurrently resulted in a sentence authorized by the statutes. They just looked at the number of years, the time that was assigned to your client. They didn't go into any analysis on whether or not these truly should have been merged offenses. And had they been merged offenses, obviously the prosecution was deprived of its statutory responsibility under the merged statute, correct?
Your Honor, when you look at the Johnson case and what Johnson held, I don't see how the prosecution was deprived of any opportunity at that sentencing hearing. They argued that they should have merged. At that point, the trial court had Harris, and it looked at Harris, and it looked at the law as it was.
Counsel, we're not going to apply Johnson. That's for the lower court. That's what the question is to remand this to and apply Johnson. You're acting like it's a foregone conclusion that these were merged offenses.
Well, I guess when I... You're telling me right now that if you won't look at Johnson, I think if you even look at Harris, which is what the trial court had before it, they're merged offenses. And what I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is that the state didn't raise the proposition of law before you to the trial court. You're right. The appeals court. The appeals court merely looked at that single assignment of error and said, well, this judge didn't merge these offenses, yet you're asking us to undo a merger that didn't happen. So I think it was a real mechanized, and I agree with you, Your Justice O'Connor, that there was not an analysis of whether or not they merged. There's some dicta in the case that actually cites Cakecroft, which was a case that was before this court, that this court remanded after Johnson, which in fact merged domestic violence and felonious assault in two sentences after this court issued Johnson.
But that was an issue that a defendant normally raises, that they don't merge them, and you didn't appeal this case.
Correct.
And the state doesn't usually challenge mergers. They don't want things merged.
Correct.
And so they're just challenging the concurrent nature of the sentence at this point.
And I guess that's what I'm trying to say is that the only legal error that we have at present is whether or not the judge should have run these sentences concurrent or merged them. And that the error that counsel was talking about is presupposed that the judge got it wrong when he said that these should merge. His only error was in not merging them. But the underlying, that's why I called it a camouflaged or a veiled attack, it's creative in that it's using 29, 29, 11, and 12, which really are the only remaining discretionary parts of the sentencing code anymore a defense attorney can use, and saying the judge took away
counsel,
discretion.
Let me turn the tables here. If you were at a sentencing hearing and the judge is reciting on the record that, I'd like to give this individual probation, community control, but it's mandatory. I feel that, I have no choice. I can not use my discretion, and I need to impose a term of actual incarceration, and therefore I impose whatever, but it's within the range. Okay?
Yes.
What would your argument be then?
My argument would be, given that we don't have a clear ruling on whether or not abuse of discretion or contrary law is the standard you look at in 29, 29, 11, or 12, I would say that the judge violated both 29, 29, 11, and 12. I would say that the sentences weren't consistent or potentially proportional with the conduct, and then I would argue that he didn't consider certain factors under Section 0.12 that would inure to my client's benefit in terms of receiving probation or not receiving.
Why would, okay, but you say you would have argued that the judge was in error in his understanding of what his responsibilities were at that time, correct?
Under the Kalish concurrence from Chief Justice O'Connor, I would argue that there was also an abuse of discretion in how the judge applied 11 and 12 to my client's particular set of facts. That's really all you have left, I believe, after Foster and now where we are with Kalish. And that's why he's grappling onto those, but it's a backdoor way to say that the trial court improperly said these two offenses should merge. And the only error, that's why I'm going back, the only error at present is should he or should he have not run them concurrent or merged them?
Mr. O'Korn, is contrary to law a broad category or is it narrow? How would you define it?
I would define it, Your Honor, as whether or not the trial court has complied with the remaining sentencing provisions that are in the Ohio Revised Code after Foster. And so that leaves a fairly limited number of statutes. What the state is arguing is that the judge violated 2941.25. They're just saying it because they're saying that he violated 29, 29, 11, 12 because the judge entered this fairly quirky finding at the end that I'm going to run these concurrent as opposed to merging them.
Counsel, here's the quandary I have. I voted to take it in all three propositions. Both of you have suggested that even though Prop 3 isn't here, it would be helpful to have an answer to that. Have you both suggested that you've backdoor briefed Prop 3 in your briefs or not?
I guess I would ask you to look at the first set of papers that were filed by my colleague, briefed is felonious assault and domestic violence allied offenses, because he has to have no answer to that to then say that 29, 29, 11, and 12 have been violated. Because, of course,
You mean what he filed in the Court of Appeals in the 10th District?
No, sir.
What he filed here?
What he filed in the memo in support of jurisdiction and what he filed in his merit brief, and I responded. Obviously, I wasn't going to let that go in my merit brief.
So you're saying Prop 3 really has been briefed?
Prop 3 has been briefed, and in my opinion, Prop 3...
Now, if we agree and go to that, that's one way to answer it. If we don't and we want to send this someplace for a resolution of that under Johnson, applying Johnson now that's out there, where's the appropriate place to send it? Trial court or the 10th District?
The trial court.
All right.
Because the trial court then, even though I didn't appeal it, will get a chance to correct, be able to clarify what it meant when it said that those two offenses should merge.
Okay. So do it here or send it to the trial court?
In my opinion, yes.
All right. Thanks.
And I would, just to expound, that even though the court, and it caused, I don't want to speak for Mr. Cousins, but it caused me confusion when I saw, okay, they're accepting on these first two propositions. They're the shell. The heart of the matter here is whether these are allied or not, because counsel for the state is saying the judge improperly limited his discretion. He took away consecutive sentences off the table. He did that because he thought these two offenses merged. In my opinion, this court has to make a determination to send this back that these two do not merge. And when you look at the elements of these offenses and you look at the decisions that have interpreted Johnson afterward, what I'm saying is the trial court in foresight got this right. And what he is saying is that, well, he took consecutive sentences off the table. Well, why did he do that? Anytime, if I'm a trial judge and I determine offense A and B merge, what am I doing? I'm taking consecutive sentences off the table. I'm limiting my discretion. And this judge applied 29, 29, 11, and 12 to the one offense. And that was proper, and it was in the sentencing entry. I see I'm under 10 seconds, and with that, I thank you, thank the court for its attention.
Thank you. Mr. Cousins, you've saved a little over 4 minutes.
Mr. Cousins, I have the same question. Do you feel the question whether or not these are allied offenses has, in fact, been briefed and is something we should address? And if not, to which court should we send this?
I think the allied offense issue has been fully briefed because it was a live issue in the trial court, but now the issue is whether the state could even raise that issue. So a merits defense under Johnson or Harris doesn't work here because the 10th District did not interpret or did not apply an allied offense analysis. So I think that this case should be remanded to the 10th District. And if the 10th District wants to remand it to the trial court for an evidentiary, a sentencing hearing to determine separate conduct
or not.
What's
the 10th District to do with it?
The 10th District held that this cannot be appealed by the state anymore. So if this court reverses that judgment and directs the 10th District to conduct an allied offense analysis, then the 10th District, within its discretion, can remand for further factual findings as to the conduct or not. But the state's fully briefed the allied offense issue to prove how there's some appealable legal error here. And defense counsel concedes that the merger belief was why the court did not impose consecutive sentences. So why can't the state appeal that belief?
Counsel, don't we get to the same point if we vacate the decision of the Court of Appeals and remand it to the trial court for consideration of Johnson, in which case not only does the allied offenses issue arise, but also the separate animus question can be argued?
I think that the trial court's free to commit the same errors, and the 10th District has held that it won't review the allied offense belief. And unless this court reverses the 10th District's judgment and adopts the state's propositions of law, I think that the 10th District will continue to hold that no matter what the legal justification for a sentence is, the state cannot appeal if the sentence falls within the realm of available sentencing options.
So vacating their decision is not sufficient to render it no longer authority on that issue?
I'm sorry, I must have misunderstood. I believe that vacating the 10th District's judgment would be appropriate, but I think that this is an issue that the 10th District has to decide, because if it goes back to the trial court, the state still hasn't received a merits determination from the Court of Appeals. Now, if the trial court...
Well, isn't that the point of remanding it for Johnson? Let the trial court use the appropriate law and based on the evidence presented to it, the argument of merger versus non-merger, and let the trial court have a do-over here.
Correct. I think that either approach would work, but as long as the 10th District's holding no longer stands and as long as this court acknowledges that an express legal error necessarily violates the sentencing statutes.
There are two separate things here. The merger issue is we've been talking about, but we also have to talk about the appealability of this particular situation. That's what you're arguing, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Correct. And it sometimes gets interwoven because the state's arguing, can this be appealed? And the defense is arguing, does the state win on the merits? Mm-hmm. And we don't know because the 10th District did not address that question. And to make crystal clear that the state didn't appeal, the state's propositions of law before this court look different from the assignment of error raised in the trial court because the state didn't anticipate that the 10th District was going to refuse to review the sentence. The state did not challenge merger, Your Honors. The state's assignment of error said the court erred by purporting to merge two crimes, purporting to merge. The state was directly challenging the subjective legal reasoning underlying the court's sentence. And the defense brief says the state does not cite 29-29-11 and 29-29-12, and I've directed this court to where the state does cite those statutes. And the state specifically said, by refusing to exercise its discretion in an area where discretion is required, the trial court violated 29-29-11 and 29-29-12. And that's at pages 1 and 2 of the state's reply brief in the 10th District.
Are you arguing that the court's reasoning can be a point of appeal because it's contrary to law?
Yes, if it refuses
that's what I wanted to...
Correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
All right.
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. Unless this court has any questions, I'd ask that this court reverse the 10th District's judgment and remand for an Allied offense determination.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our opinion. Marshall, would you call a recess?